Welcome to the Canadian Nutrition Society podcast, Nutrition Conversations, a podcast dedicated to exploring the latest research in nutrition and health in Canada. In each episode, we invite expert guests to share their insight and knowledge on a wide range of topics, from dietary patterns to sports nutrition, food insecurity, and food sustainability. Whether you're looking to improve your own health and wellness, or simply stay up to date on the latest developments in the field of nutrition, we hope you'll join us on this journey to better understand the role food plays in our lives. Please note that the views expressed by speakers in CNS podcasts are those of the speaker and not necessarily of CNS. Sitting in the host chair in this episode is the Scientific Director of the Canadian Nutrition Society, Dr. Sharon Panahi, who will be talking to Dr. Dylan McKay on Season 2, Episode 6 of Nutrition Conversations on connecting nutritional strategies with chronic disease prevention.
Hello, Nutrition Conversations listeners. Chronic conditions such as diabetes and chronic kidney disease are major public health concerns and on the rise worldwide. Dietary interventions that include foods such as fruits and vegetables may help improve health outcomes, but what about adherence? Could providing foods directly to people as part of health services be a solution? Joining us on this episode is Dr. Dylan McKay, who's an assistant professor of nutrition and chronic disease in the Department of Food and Human Nutritional Sciences in the Department of Internal Medicine Section Endocrinology at the University of Manitoba. He has a background in human nutritional sciences with training and experience in clinical trials and patient-oriented research. He is also a person who lives with type 1 diabetes, and his work focuses primarily on glucose metabolism, type 2 diabetes, and chronic kidney disease. Dr. McKay also has a strong personal connection with type 1 diabetes research, in which he is both a researcher and a person with lived experience. This past June, Dr. McKay also stepped out onto the catwalk to try his hand modeling at a Diabetes Canada Pump Couture event, which was an evening dedicated to changing the conversation around the stigma of living with diabetes through a fun night of fashion and fundraising. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you, Dylan, to episode 6 of season 2 of Nutrition Conversations.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, thank you for being here with us. So living with type 1 diabetes has undoubtedly offered you a very personal understanding of the condition. So maybe we can start off with you telling us a little bit about your journey with type 1 diabetes and perhaps how that has provided you with a unique perspective on your research and the various different areas that you work in.
Yeah, there's no question that my developing type 1 diabetes, I was diagnosed when I was 13, basically has shaped my career path. And so I always say that I was thinking after the diagnosis, I was thinking about food and nutrition and the impact on health all the time. So I figured I'd get a career in that as well. So I could just, get paid to do the same kind of thinking. And as well, my mother was a registered dietitian. So there's those two things that were definitely shaping why I'm now a nutrition researcher and interested in clinical trials and diabetes.
Well, I love how your personal story and history is sort of intertwined with your professional work. And so what about the different areas that you work and how has that sort of, affected the different areas of research?
Yeah, I think I would say I specialize, or the research group, myself and Dr. Rebecca Mollard, the M&M lab, we specialize in clinical trials, so interventions in humans. She brings in a lot of experience doing glucose response trials, and I have lived experience of having a chronic disease related to glucose metabolism. And what we do whenever we're working in a certain condition is we just engage with people with lived experience of those conditions. And so that's sort of something that I started when I was in graduate school. I was a person with lived experience on a research project for type 1. And I just saw how important that is. And it just makes sense. So every project we do, we try to inform it with, people representing the population. That doesn't happen all the time when we're, maybe testing a new food for just general glucose response. But in general, we always try to reach out and recruit people to help us make these projects better that represent the populations that we're targeting for our interventions. The idea that clinical trials were intervening in humans, it's the closest, you know, level to potentially translating the results to those people in those populations. It's why I've selected that area, because I want to hopefully be generating evidence that, you know, within my lifetime might be changing how people are treated or how they manage their conditions.
Right. And so in a lot of the work that you do, I know you emphasize the importance of evidence-based approaches to deliver interventions to reach those who may not have the resources, for example, or knowledge to make significant dietary changes, such as in the context of the chronic diseases that we mentioned before. And you've done a lot of work in the area of diabetes and chronic kidney disease. So could you perhaps share some insights into your current projects and maybe how they aim to bridge some of these gaps in these chronic diseases in the management of these?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that, you know, clinical trials are challenging, and developing evidence that will translate is challenging, and more so in nutrition, I think, than in, say, pharmacological interventions, because everyone has to eat, right? It's not like adding a medication that or replacing a medication. And so you're changing how you eat and why you eat what you eat is formed by lots of things that are likely out of your control, right? Where you live, how you grew up, the culture you grew up in, the economic bracket and the you know, geography, the food geography around you. And so making interventions or just telling people to change their diet for a condition may not necessarily work because there could be all kinds of barriers. They want to change their diet and just simply cannot. So those are the kind of things that, you know, we approach all our projects in. And so right now, what we're doing some research in chronic kidney disease is obviously a condition that is very tightly linked to diet. And what we eat is, you know, a lot of the nutrients are handled by the kidneys. And as kidney function fails, or is reduced, there are issues with many nutrients. And so I've been very lucky to get to work with some fantastic nephrologists. And one of the conditions that we're working in right now is metabolic acidosis. And so basically as the kidney function declines, maintaining acid-base balance becomes difficult. And the acid load that a kidney deals with every day comes almost exclusively from the diet. So it's a condition where if you modified that acid load, then the condition could disappear because you're no longer having the kidneys work so hard to maintain acid-base balance. So that's an area where through our work with one of the nephrologists, we saw that people have been piloting or looking at delivering high bicarbonate, so low acid fruits and vegetables, or fruits and vegetables that deliver bicarbonate equivalents, as a treatment for that condition. Currently, the pharmacological treatment is sodium bicarbonate tablets, like baking soda tablets. And as you can imagine, that's probably, it is a very unpleasant treatment. It's kind of like you're neutralizing the acid in your stomach multiple times a day with large pills of high dose sodium, baking soda, basically. And so gastrointestinal discomfort, there's a lot of people who don't continue those medications because of how they negatively impact the quality of life. And so one of the ideas is if we can reduce the dietary acid load through changing the diet, then we don't need to neutralize it. It's already gone. Or you can even just add basic foods and remove the need for any additional medications to reduce the acid load. So that was the first big trial we're looking at with delivery of fruits and vegetables.
Right. And so in some of those studies, and in particular, I'm looking at a paper from 2023 in relation to what you're discussing on dietary potassium liberalization with fruits and vegetables versus the potassium restriction in people with CKD. And so you talk a little bit about the food delivery to homes, and I was kind of intrigued by this. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the acid-base metabolic acidosis study started really by talking to people with the condition and hearing about their diets and seeing that there's a potential to change that condition modify the condition by giving people the food. But it didn't seem to work when you just told people to change their diet. You know, you had to deliver the foods. And so we thought, you know, working with existing delivery infrastructures at grocery stores would be the way to do that. And so we reached out to some grocery stores, local ones and some larger chains, and we've actually developed some relationships with grocery stores. And in this metabolic acidosis study, we're working with Save on Foods to deliver fruits and vegetables. And the dietary liberalization study, actually, when we were trying to get the metabolic acidosis study funded and we were submitting it to CIHR and other funding bodies, the feedback we always received from reviewers was, oh, in chronic kidney disease, the potassium in fruits and vegetables is going to be too dangerous. Hyperkalemia is very dangerous in chronic kidney disease. And these are fruits and vegetables. The ones that have lots of bicarbonate also are the ones that have lots of potassium. And there was a lot of fear from the reviewers about that topic. And so we actually decided to build a trial to test that. You know, does the potassium from fruits and vegetables matter that much? Because in speaking to some of the nephrologists that treat the condition, they're not convinced that fruits and vegetable potassium is really the cause of it. They know that if they change medications and diuretics, they can strongly influence potassium. But the evidence for dietary potassium from the foods we eat strongly influencing the potassium levels in this population is really weak. We went and looked for it and we basically couldn't find any evidence. You know, some studies suggested that the different types of potassium might matter. So elemental potassium in a food versus a potassium found in a natural food matrix, like a fruit or vegetable, could be very different. But we just didn't see any trials that showed eating more potassium through fruits and vegetables was leading to hyperkalemia. And so that led to this trial, just basically reviewer feedback saying you can't do this because we think it's too dangerous, led to us creating another trial where we said, well, we'll do one looking at safety, where we deliver high potassium fruits and vegetables to individuals with chronic kidney disease and see if we're really influencing potassium levels that much that we have to be concerned. And this is really important because right now people with elevated potassium with chronic kidney disease are being told to restrict their diets. And we've heard in focus groups from this population that it's so hard to restrict, like all of the things they're told to restrict, you know, monitor the protein amount, monitor the amount of liquids they're consuming, monitor their phosphate intake, their sodium intake, their potassium intake. It becomes either information overload and they just basically don't eat anything, or they just eat like toast and tea or something they know is okay and nothing else. And so we want to explore if it's really dangerous to have the higher potassium intakes from fruits and vegetables. And if not, can we change the recommendation so people can have a greater variety in their diet and hopefully increase quality of life?
Okay, so some of these studies are still ongoing then?
That all of the studies are ongoing. I mean, every study I'm doing right now since I started independently, I started in 2019, and the pandemic sort of stopped everything, including in human trials, for almost a year and a half in Manitoba. So I wouldn't recommend it to start your early career in a pandemic, unless you're like a vaccine researcher or a viral antiviral researcher.
Right. And so in some of these studies, you've also, I noticed, done some qualitative assessments, especially in the fruit and vegetable studies, using exit interviews or focus groups to explore some of the barriers and facilitators of the intervention. So what specific insights do you aim to derive from these conversations, and how do these insights perhaps shape your approach to the dietary interventions?
Yeah, I think that kind of qualitative data collection along with clinical trials, especially in nutrition, is very valuable. So even before we've funded these trials, we were doing focus groups from people who represent the populations to help inform the interventions and the research questions. And we plan in these ongoing trials to do exit interviews and or focus groups to get information on the interventions, because it's really important that we're testing an intervention or knowing that our intervention had a chance to work, right? You don't want to design a clinical trial where you give an intervention and you hear, well, that would never have worked for me, because then you might find out that, say, you were delivering fruits and vegetables to someone's house, and if we hear back afterwards that that population just didn't have the physical capacity to prepare those foods. then that doesn't mean that the consuming fruits and vegetables couldn't work as an intervention. Maybe we need to then just deliver ready-to-eat foods rather than the groceries. Or maybe for certain individuals, we need to deliver those foods ready-to-eat. And so we could adapt or modify the intervention to make sure it works best in more people. And that's not something you can necessarily collect if you're just doing a clinical trial and you're, say, looking at an outcome, like a value in the blood. And you see, oh, well, it didn't change significantly. And then if you look at it, and it did in some people and it didn't others, if that group that it didn't work in said, well, you know, I never really could eat all of the food I needed to because I didn't have the kitchen time or the my hands. You know, if you're working with a population, say, rheumatoid arthritis, they may know very well what they have to eat, but they could have barriers to preparing the intervention for themselves. And that's where we do the interviews and the qualitative research to try to make the next intervention better or find a way to translate the intervention better, either the next round or when we move forward to whatever the next steps of the research is.
Right. And I know the practical aspects of food preparation, like you mentioned, can often be a barrier to healthy eating. So the peeling, chopping, storing, cooking, and so on, like it is time consuming. And I know you have some projects related to food work, and maybe some other initiatives or projects that I'm not currently aware of. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
I think I can suggest a future podcast episode on food work where you speak to Dr. Leah Cahill at Dalhousie, because she is an important collaborator on the metabolic acidosis study we're doing in CKD now. And from the various grant applications we've written from that and engagement with people with lived experience who were on the team. So we had co-applicants who had lived experience of chronic kidney disease on those teams. We heard about and we talked about the barriers to like why this might not work, right? And and so a lot of that came down to food work, and food work, at least as how we define it, is all the work around, you know, making meals to consume, whether at work or at home, that you prepare yourself. So, you know, it's like the planning, the shopping, the washing, the prepping, the chopping, the cooking, and the cleanup. All of that is food work. And so Dr. Cahill went and looked, and we don't really have any good tools to measure that. You know, it's not the same as food literacy. And so that's a really cool project that we sort of spun from this original idea. How do we measure that? And how do we then, I hope once the tool is ready to use, we're going to use it in all our interventions to see, you know, how food work might be a barrier or a facilitator of the interventions that we test in our trials. So I definitely recommend that as a future episode, just all about food work.
Well, thank you for that suggestion. Mm-hmm. I love that. I'll definitely put it on our list of future podcasts. And so one thing I wanted to also touch on was the fact that people generally have a strong preference for fruits and vegetables. And we've talked a little bit about how their preparation can be time consuming, but also that food is also one of our greatest pleasures. Eating is a social activity. And then now we're saying, eat this, don't eat that. There's so many different messages we're giving to people. And I guess what I'm getting to is sort of the medicalization of food. And we've all heard the infamous quote by Hippocrates, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. So do you consider this food as medicine?
Yeah, I don't love that quote, and apparently Hippocrates didn't actually say it. It was misattributed, it was likely sort of coined by someone who was selling a diet book sometime in the 60s. But I think food is critically important for health, and so around the interventions that we develop, we try to make them adaptable as possible. So in our food delivery trials, we have lists of foods that people select from, and we try to adapt them to their preferences and maybe their cultural dietary backgrounds. We work with RDs in educating the individuals along with the delivery of the foods of how to integrate them into the diet. And I think that's critical for designing trials and interventions that can be translated afterwards, right? If you're giving people all of the foods they need, you're really going to be doing an efficacy trial, because it'd be very difficult to replicate that afterwards in the healthcare system. But I kind of want to look at developing almost effectiveness trials or developing evidence for interventions that we can then translate and use in the healthcare system. So we work with health economists to try to come up with a cost effectiveness of our interventions as well, relative to say what the pharmacological control would be. And I think the concept of food as medicine, sometimes I feel like it's just used often by people who are selling diets. And I think it's a great concept maybe for like community-based interventions or environmental-based interventions that remove barriers to food access and healthy foods. But I worry when we say, let your medicine be your food and your food be your medicine, we're forgetting that food, even healthy people have to eat food. And there's so much more to food than just getting the macro and micronutrients you need, right? There's pleasure and companionship and connection and heritage that's in food. And so medicalizing it, you know, destroys all of those. And I think it can probably lead to, you know, mental health issues, which are also, you know, like if you pathologize eating, you could have stress, which is also, we know is bad, right? Or if you remove all those pleasures from your life, you can have stress that can be bad for your health. So I don't love the food as medicine concept. You know, it's something I try to avoid. I think food's critical for health, but you actually minimize food when you call it a medicine. I also think it also overpromises sometimes, because I think the impact of a lot of food interventions are small and long over time. And when at least in, you know, the North American European concept of medicine, we're thinking of fast, right? Like quick fixes, you know, vaccines that prevent a condition. I take this drug, this condition's fixed. Whereas the relationship with food, even when you're healthy or if you, you know, are cured from a condition, you're still going to have to eat every day. So, yeah.
Right. So I guess in the end, food is food and medicine is medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're very important for each other, I think.
No, I agree. And so, I mean, that's a very interesting viewpoint. And so I guess looking at everything as a whole and sort of as we start to conclude, it's important to reflect on the broader implications of the work and direction of future research. So what advice would you say you would have for fellow nutrition researchers, and what key messages would you like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm really privileged. I get to work in trials, and that's close to the translation. But, you know, in the nutrition field, I think we really need to have a view towards, you know, understanding how nutrition works. But then when we're testing interventions, especially in terms of conditions and chronic diseases, with an eye towards, could they ever be translated, or what's the best way they could be translated? Because if we're doing a lot of studies where we're developing hypotheses and never moving to the next step, right? Like say we're, you know, like, oh, this is associated with this, but you know, the association without the causation, we get lots of newspaper coverage, I guess, and lots of clicks on social media, but moving the findings along that pathway to where we can be impacting the people that have that condition is really what I think everybody in nutrition should be thinking about, you know, like not just the results or showing that this product works well for this condition, but how do we move that so that that product or that diet or that intervention will make it to those people, and those people have the chance of getting the benefit from that intervention. And I know that doesn't mean that there's not very important cell and animal work in nutrition that's being done. But thinking the whole way along, well, what are the next stages? When I show this is really interesting in cells, how am I moving this along to the next step? And building those pipelines with other researchers to really have impact for people, you know, the end population, you know, Canadians or you know, people around the world, humans from our research. And trying to, whenever possible, not contribute extra noise to certain conditions or, you know, areas of research. I think a great example of that is this idea around, you know, sugar and artificial sweeteners. I haven't seen that field move forward in a very long time, but there's tons of research in it. And I really wish the researchers in that field start thinking together as a big group, how do we move this forward? How do we work together to answer some of these questions that consumers or, you know, people who eat food, so everybody, are looking for the answer to, rather than just giving them more questions. Because if we confuse people who eat enough, then they sort of ignore us, right? Because they've been told they can or they can't eat this food 100 different times, and then they just decide, well, I like this food, that's what I'm going to eat. So yeah,
I think those are some great points and great takeaways for our listeners. And maybe before I let you go, I know we were sort of going to end with these key takeaways, but I'm also very curious about this recent event that you participated in for the Diabetes Canada on hand modeling. And apparently you were participating in...
Oh, no, not hand modeling. I was a model, like a model. So you tried my hand, like just testing out. I was last night was a show in Winnipeg, I did three runs on a runway of with different clothes and different outfits. It was set up with lights and music and introduction. It's a fashion show. It started in Toronto 3 years ago. This is the first time it was in Winnipeg, and it's across Canada. And people with type 1 diabetes, and we had some kids as young as 6 or 7. We had one man who he was right behind me in the modeling lineup. He was 76 years old. Every model had diabetes, and we were wearing local clothing lines and walking on a runway, just a model show that was produced. And it's a fundraiser for Diabetes Canada D Camps. So those are the camps that bring children with type 1 diabetes together to do summer camp experiences and outside of a controlled environment where they have physicians and, you know, staff on hand who run these camps. And as counselors, they wouldn't be able to have a camp experience, right? Because type 1 has risks, especially around activity and often as a child with type 1 diabetes, you're learning your care. So there are people there that can help with the care, that give your parents a break, but you also learn a little more independence, and they're just fantastic programs. And so, hopefully we raised, over $100,000 for those D camps, this year. I'm looking forward to being a part of it next year, raising even more money. And there's a potential where we might start raising money for diabetes research as well beyond the D camps. So I'm excited about that because I'm always trying to get that Diabetes Canada research money, and so if there's more of it, maybe there's more of it for all of us to go around and do some research with. So
well, that's wonderful, and I apologize because I understood it as hand modeling, but this is regular modeling. So
regular modeling, yeah. So I practiced a runway walk, and it was really fun. It was just a big crowd of people cheering, and you get to just show off surviving with type 1 diabetes. So it was really fun.
Oh, that's wonderful. And thank you so much, Dylan, for sharing your perspectives, your expertise, your experience with this fun event, and all of the great work that you're doing in such diverse areas.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Nutrition Conversations. We hope that you found today's discussion informative and inspiring. If you're interested in hearing more about the latest research in nutrition and health, be sure to check out our website at cns-scn.ca/podcast for upcoming episodes. You can find us on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Simply search for the Nutrition Conversations podcast on your favorite app, and you'll have access to all our episodes in one place. We release new episodes at the end of each month, so mark your calendars and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode.